Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. We've done a series of programs on higher education and what its relevance is to our high-tech, rapidly changing world. We now continue that discussion at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. Created by the state legislature in 1967, its founding purpose was to offer integrated, flexible, and reasonably priced education for careers in public service, science, entrepreneurship, education, and the arts. And it is fair to say its academic approach is unorthodox. After nearly 50 years, how are things going? Evergreen's president, Dr. Les Peirce, has some views about that. Dr. Peirce, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Yes, nice to be here to talk with you.
Where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
Grew up in Pocatello, Idaho, railroad town, gateway to the west. You know, it's where the train split up and went north to Montana and west to Portland and Seattle.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yes.
What'd your folks do?
My dad worked for the railroad for 35 years after coming out in World War II to an air base that was there in Pocatello at the time. And my mom was born and raised in Pocatello. Her name's Idaho Peirce.
Really?
Oh, yes. She ended up being a supervisor for employment security at the end of her career, but as a young person had a number of jobs with a telephone company and S.H. Kress when she was just out of high school.
Brothers and sisters?
Two brothers, one who passed recently, and two sisters.
Where'd you go to high school, Pocatello?
Went to Pokey High School. At that time, the only high school in town. Then went on to Idaho State University, which is in Pocatello.
What'd you study?
I studied psychology, had a minor in art history. Went on to get a master's and a doctorate in counselor education and counseling psychology.
If I asked you, the young man going off to college, what were the most important values you had learned to that point that are still important to you? What would you say?
Well, I think without question, two things. One, from my folks, the importance of education and the effect it has, and also just the whole idea about the responsibility that you have to society.
Let's elaborate on those.
Well, they taught us that education was a great equalizer. If we were going to advance as African-American people, that you had to have the kind of tools that no one could ever take from you. That was always the message.
And that was delivered explicitly?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. To all of us, there was that expectation that all of us would go on to college, and all of us did, and all of us got bachelor's degrees. It was done in a way that was earnest and intelligent, as my folks were and my mother is still.
And the second was social responsibility. Well, how was that presented and in what context?
Well, it's the idea that not only do you become educated to be able to have a good job and provide for your family, but that with that education you receive, that you have an obligation to the greater whole, to the democracy, to your community, to your place in it, and to your fellow people that are in a community.
Let me just explore that just a little bit. Another ethic that might be taught, or is certainly taught to some people, is you have a responsibility to yourself, period, and there'll be some benefits to other people, but look after yourself.
Well, I come from a very tightly knit family and community that came from that. And the issue of the individual good, in my opinion, can't be separated from the connections that we have to the rest of humanity. I mean, that's what I was taught. It's what I believe. I know some people believe that. It's not what I believe.
Would you say in that particular time, place, your family, when were you growing up? What period of time?
It would have been the 50s.
50s, okay.
Yes.
That's early civil rights era, the 60s.
It is. I graduated from high school during the middle of the civil rights movement.
Okay. Would you say being an African-American family affected that presentation of the ethical responsibility to society in any way, or was it not specific to that experience that was going on in the country?
Well, I think that my race set the context, given the history that we've had in this country around race. And my folks are very much activists. My dad was president for years at NAACP, and my mother was the founding chair of the Idaho State Humanities Human Rights Commission. Hmm. They're very active on a very high scale in the state politically especially around social activist issues that had to do with social justice.
Your doctorate was in?
Counseling psychology. I'm a counselor educator.
Okay, now you end up as, I'm going to short circuit this, you get to be president of the Evergreen State College. Is that an unorthodox degree if we look at presidents of colleges and universities around the country?
Well, the degree is not unorthodox because typically what's required is a doctoral degree or a terminal degree to be eligible to be a president.
I understand. I mean, yes. That specific degree in counseling psychology.
Well, I don't think that people make judgments by the time you become a president as to what your specific terminal doctoral degree is in, because by that time you would have had the kind of administrative experience in higher education that would make you attractive for a presidency.
So let's talk about that a little bit in a nutshell, and I'm always conscious of the time here.
Uh-huh.
You get your degree, you teach?
Yes, and I've taught graduate school for a while. But I was interested in public life as well. In fact, I was always torn between politics and education, and at some point got involved in politics and served as a councilman and the mayor of my city in Pocatello.
Elective
at the time.
Politics.
Yes, yes. I did that while I was a graduate student when I ran, and then
You're
when
kidding.
I was teaching.
That's fairly young.
Probably 26, I guess.
What did you learn doing that political work that you didn't know before you got into politics at the end of that political career?
Well, I think that I learned how hard the work is. I certainly learned what it meant and the public policy work that really goes into shaping our communities and how important it is to have political leaders that understand that and that have some sort of personal ethical foundation for why they want to run or serve.
When were you appointed as president of this college?
2000.
So we're 14 years in.
July, it'll be 14 years.
Why did you want the job?
Well, I had been here before. I came to the college originally in 89 as a vice president and served as interim president for the college for a couple of years, and then left and took a vice presidency at Washington State University after we had hired a permanent president. Then, 7 years later, after I had left, this job came open again, and I had an option of deciding if I want to stay at a land-grant institution or not. But I had really loved the experience I had had at Evergreen, the way we teach.
Why? Tell me about it.
Well, Evergreen is grounded in the idea of, first of all, we were designed to serve transfer students from the community college system. And the whole idea of our liberal arts approach to education was that a kid who comes from a rural area or from an urban area ought to have an opportunity to have a very high-quality liberal arts education that is similar to what a lot of people get from private schools that can afford to go. And I've often said to the legislature, why shouldn't a kid from Pomeroy, Washington, or Colville, or the inner-city Seattle have an opportunity to have a science and arts education that's high-quality, that gives them a solid foundation of an education to go in whatever direction they want. And I like the fact that Evergreen did that and that it's committed to some of the values I have, like social justice, the environment. We come from a long history from the beginning of concerns about the environment and all of those areas. So it was attractive for me to come back because it was consistent with what my values are.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We are talking with President of the Evergreen State College, Dr. Les Peirce. Tell us about the founding goals. It's, first of all, I notice a very unorthodox campus. It's something like 1,000 acres, and it was founded in the 60s.
Well, you know, the 60s was a time when the baby boomers, like myself, were coming in huge numbers. The state of Washington had grown to the point where the demographics said that it needed another four-year institution. The legislature, when they mandated the search for this institution, had given the direction at that time because of a lot of concern and dissatisfaction with what the traditional kind of form of education had been, and a lot of questioning about how successful and effective it was, that not only would they form a new institution, but that institution should be different and innovative and use a different kind of approach to delivering education. So the Evergreen was founded on that principle, and the founding faculty decided that they would throw out a lot of the old kind of traditional kinds of setups for colleges, like departments, which they saw as being divisive and competitive, like grades, which they thought really didn't tell you how well someone was doing. It was just a letter. So we developed an approach that is interdisciplinary in its approach. In other words, you bring together a theologian and a scientist and a sociologist, and they form their programs. The discipline comes from the integration of their disciplines around a theme or a problem. And so the faculty would spend a year planning a curriculum, and out of that curriculum, a student could get introductory or advanced sociology, the foundations of theology, and if it's a scientist or a chemist, to see what role chemistry or some aspect of science plays in our society or in problems that have been identified. That way, a student gets their education in the way we live life, and that is interdisciplinarily. You can see the connections between things. And also, it's set up in a seminar system because the expectation is that you work in teams. It's not based on competitiveness. It's based on cooperation. It's based on being able to identify the people that have the strengths in one area and the weaknesses that they may have in another and you may have, and being able to build on those to be successful at moving towards a goal, much like we ultimately would like to be able to do in life or at work. Rather than grades, they're summative evaluations of your performance. Expectation also that you'll evaluate the faculty member on their work when they do this work with you. So very different and very intense work for faculty, but a very powerful for experience education-wise for students that become immersed in that kind of experience. It's very student-centered. It's not the sage on the stage that says, read all of these pages, and if you want to get a C, put in these kinds of handbooks or do this kind of work and you'll get that C. It puts the student at the middle of the stage and says, here are our expectations and here are the things that we'll cover, and you'll demonstrate that you understand it in writing and orally through groups and projects and workshops, and your credit will be allocated based on the degree to which you accomplish that work, and your faculty members evaluate you. Not only that, each of the faculty members are required to do lectures for the total group of people, 25 students each, that's 75 together. So at least once a week, a different faculty member lectures on sociology or some aspect of that around the problem. The rest of the faculty, like the students, are students then, learning about what goes on, reading books they've never read from their own discipline. Students get to see faculty also as learners. And it teaches lifelong learning. It teaches that we're always learning, and everyone doesn't have all of the knowledge.
Well, that summary, having been through a more conventional college experience, clearly is based on different assumptions than where I went to school. For example, the team versus the individual, individual grades. You've been the president here for more than 10 years. How do you judge it? How do you see it working student by student? Because ultimately you can have a team, but they are individuals within that team. What's your dropout rate? How do you measure success? Tell me something that I can, okay, that's a very radical, interesting concept. Something that says that I'm an outside observer. How well is it working?
There's an organization and a evaluation system, National Survey of Student Engagement, it's called, and it measures the kind of things that they deem as being important, and that is the level of challenge that students report themselves in the classroom, their connectedness and the work that they do outside of the classroom in their learning, and their ability to articulate that learning at the end of their work. And Evergreen is consistently in the country scored at the highest among its peers in those kinds of areas. What are the challenges? Well, one of the big challenges has to do, of course, initially with retention with freshmen that come to the college, because all of us come out of a silo system, and you have to adjust to a system where you really have responsibility for your education, especially in education where there aren't any requirements. You map out what direction you want to go, you aren't required to take a certain thing first, much like the traditional education
right.
is. But you have faculty that are advising you in regard to the kind of courses that will get you where you want to go. That pathway, oftentimes, for some people, are a real challenge.
Because I was going to say, it assumes a certain level of maturity and personal leadership.
Absolutely. Bear. Absolutely. It does. And it's probably, without question, some of the hardest challenges that people have that come as high school directs. Our students tend to be a little older, average age 26. Half of our students come from the community college system, so they tend to be a little older when they get here, and that makes a difference as well.
Let me just jump in. When you say the average age is 26 and some come from community colleges, that means some don't. Are those people who might have tried conventional education, it didn't work for them, and they're coming back in?
No, those would be high school directs.
Okay.
The other section would be our cohort of classes that come directly from high school, in-state and out-of-state, that have chosen to come to Evergreen. So you have part of the mix that comes directly to us as freshmen and spend 4 years with us, largely,
right.
and those that transfer with 90 credits from the community college system that join the college.
Any difference
as well.
In performance on average between those two sets?
Well, it's not the retention levels are higher with the students that have come from the community college by and large.
Okay.
They're older. They're probably more focused on where they want to go. And the programs that they have at the senior level are probably more focused in the areas that they've chosen to focus their education on. But not greatly so. But those are really the kind of challenges and the structures that we have. There are a number of things that we've learned over the years that we continue to work on. Because we operate in groups rather than in silos where there are classes of cohorts, mm-hmm. the student that graduates doesn't tend to remember, oh, I remember the engineering department. Boy, I'm going to give you $1 million. It set my life. What they tend to remember are the faculty and the programs that made a difference in their lives, that shaped the direction that they went. So you don't have the same handles from a advancement or a development or fundraising point of view to make the same kind of connections. People tend to be engaged with the group that they're in. That 75 people will make friendships for a long time in their lives, but they may not have as deep a connection with a broader group of students or programs because of the way we organize.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We are talking with President of the Evergreen State College, Dr. Les Peirce. These young people are leaving here and going into a highly technological world where knowledge tends to be more and more specialized, you could argue deep and narrow at the same time. It seems to me this education, both because it's teamwork instead of just the individual and it's interdisciplinary, might suggest they're going to have problems fitting into the silos that are out there, specialists. What's the experience that you've had as the president with your graduates? What do they come back in 5 years and tell you happened?
Well, we know what happens. We know that by the end of 3 years that well over 85% of them will have gone on to graduate school or gone into some other profession that they've chosen. It's not surprising, and it's really the test of the education as well because they have to take GREs like everyone else, and we have doctors and lawyers and the whole range of scientists and PhDs over the years. We have now almost over 45,000 alums, and so at age 42, we kind of get a sense of what is emerging, and we're still very, very young. But you get that kind of message in a sense of people in terms of what they've chosen and what their leadership is. We've had a couple of congressmen. We have a new one that's just been elected for this district and a couple that have been chief of staff to governors. So people that go to Evergreen tend to have a real sense of like public service, many of them do. The connection that they have with political economy. We have a lot of students that have really emerged as leaders in a number of those areas. And the same is true in the arts. Matt Groening of The Simpsons, he ran our school paper and went to L.A. with all of his cartoons and voila, The Simpsons. It's a pretty extraordinary thing. Lynda.com, the digital education program system, is another one of our bright leaders that have emerged. Well, we have a number, we're like many places. Yeah, the people that become the superstars, but most about what I've learned about our alumni are that they tend to be entrepreneurs. The benefit of this kind of an education is that people gain profound confidence in their ability to learn, because it's the sorting out kind of process when you're working on projects and you're looking at problems and you have to work as a team to divine them. You find people that come out with a huge confidence about being able to solve problems. That's what businesses report. They love our people because they aren't afraid to try something that they don't know. And it's because they've gained the tools and the confidence through their education to be able to say, well, I'll look into it and try to figure it out. That's a powerful statement.
I understand the concept, and it's highly interesting to me that that team approach and interdisciplinary approach leads to skills that you describe as entrepreneurial. Can you give me an example of a class or classroom setting that is specific so I can understand how you generate that through the classroom?
I participate in a class every fall with freshmen that come in. There are core programs that are interdisciplinary like I've described to you. Some years ago, I was involved in a program. The name of it was Trash. And what it was, it was the politics of waste. The freshmen came in, and the first week we took all of the garbage that we had on the campus, and we emptied it out on the ground out in the back of the campus, and the students were asked to weigh it and to separate it out and then to put it back in the trash cans, and then to write an essay about what did that trash say about the Evergreen State College. They had to weigh it, and they wanted to know, what does that tell you about what goes through here, what's processed? Then we followed that trash from the campus to one of the repositories out in this area, and then we followed it on a train out to Roosevelt, Washington, ultimately where it was disposed. We camped out on the Columbia River, went to the waste site, talked with the waste managers, and then came back and had discussions with the people that are involved with managing waste here on the campus. And then they had conversations with people in communities, and some of the questions were, what are your feelings about waste? How does the policies in regard to waste work? One of the things that was shocking to them was they thought when we recycled that everything went into recycling. When they learned that it depended on the price that they were getting for the paper that week as to if it went into the trash or was recycled, was an eye-opener to them. Then they wanted to know, well, what's the public policy behind that? Who makes the decisions? What are the implications for how we deal with it now? And what would they propose that may be counter to that? Out of that came a group of kids in that class that began a whole major recycling ethos here at Evergreen about the use of food waste and how it connected to the campus life itself. That generated a hands-on, practical, applied approach to recycling and waste that benefited the campus and ultimately those people in their lives in ways we never could have imagined. Theory to practice, and then the mutual integration and collaboration among people on a non-competitive but cooperative way. That would be an example I would give you.
We've been doing an informal series on education in America from preschool to through higher education, and I'd like to get your sense for some basic issues. One thing that jumps out at me is that roughly up to a third of American kids don't graduate high school. That dooms them to lower economic success, lower happiness, higher crime, more difficulties. What's your sense as a college president about what we should be doing about this as a culture and why?
From my perspective, as I've stated before, I see public education as a vehicle to strengthen our society. And you're right. The issues around poverty and its growth and what we know now from data about the prospect of young people, of kids, being able to get out of that cycle are just devastating.
Yes.
The likelihood of a kid in the last 5th percentile being able to get to the upper 5th percentile is something like 0.3%. You know, it's like nil almost. Because
so the idea
no
of social mobility.
The whole idea of social mobility, which right. is what the public system in our country with the Morrill Act initially was founded on. I think that we cannot lose sight of that at a time when we're moving towards more disinvestment in the greater good and an increasing perspective somehow for many that education is an individual good rather than a public good.
I interviewed President George Denison, now former president of the University of Montana, who told me approximately this. In 1970, 70% of Americans believed the primary beneficiary of a higher education was the society, and as a result, they were willing to pay, if I remember right, 60 to 70% of the education of the cost of a college degree. In the year 2000, that figure had reversed. Now 30% thought it was a public benefit, 70% thought the primary beneficiary was the individual, and therefore the individual should pay, and therefore they would not fund public education at a higher level.
And I would respond to that, and I think that he's right on, and I would just pose this question to us. Why is it now in the 25 years when I've come to this state that when 65% of the education, 75 when I came here, like he pointed out, was paid by the public to support those that were coming to college, at a time when there's such a critical need for those who are now experiencing this gap in education, that are the poor and the first generation people, and the demographics that have changed in terms of who's now coming to college, which are the most needy, that we now have had a turn in public policy that says we're disinvesting by and large unless you go into engineering or some STEM area. And
STEM,
that,
I don't understand.
Well, that's science, technology, science and engineering and technology.
Okay.
That means that this disinvestment is happening at a time when the most needy individuals that will be part of the future of our country, that will support many of us baby boomers in our retirement, are not having access to the potential to have the kind of success at the most basic level that will be critical for a shrinking society. I think it's a very important public policy issue that we have to get our arms around.
You've had serious experience in politics and education. You're living in an era where it's becoming more popular to say survival of the fittest, each individual for him or herself, rather than the good of the community. What's your sense for that line of reasoning as applied to higher education? Do it on your own.
The reality is that there will be large segments of our population that simply will not be able to do it on their own. It's something that I think that we have to face, particularly when we think about how short-sighted it is in terms of what the implications are for a growing segment of our population that are ill-educated, that have little hope in terms of their own ability to have upward mobility and to aspire to the things that we say we are in the country. That has the prospect of tearing at our fabric in ways that we cannot imagine, and that is not in the best interest of those that are the most highly paid or that are the elite in any way, because it means that it really hits directly at the threat of the stability of our country.
Do you see it possibly turning around?
Well, I think there are a lot of people that are committed to reinvesting in our country. And I think that the way you do that is have strong public conversations about what is at stake and the opening of strategies to be able to gain access for people that historically have not been able to benefit from our educational system.
President Les Peirce, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.